Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Later in the program, I have an interview with Joan Nathan, author of several cookbooks including The Flavor of Jerusalem, Jewish Cooking in America, and most recently, King Solomon's Table. Joan talks about her experiences collecting Jewish recipes from all over the diaspora. I'll also be talking with Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. The garden is exploding with life, and we have a lot to talk about. But first, I was going through the food show archives and came across an interview with Sander Katz, author of Wild Fermentations and generally a champion of all things fermentation. I had the privilege of sitting down with Sander a few years back when he was visiting Portland for the Fermentation Festival. Sander starts by telling a story about a trip to Indonesia where he witnessed tempeh made using a traditional process and how vastly different other countries and cultures treat microbiota than the United States. Here is Sander Katz.
So tempeh is a style of fermenting soybeans where you basically use molds that digest the soybeans and also bind them together into a mat that's typically sliced up and fried, and it comes from the Indonesian island of Java. Tempeh has been available in the United States since the 70s, and it's really easy to trace exactly how tempeh became popular in the U.S. and it was sort of through the vegetarian subcultures and specifically from a community in Tennessee called The Farm, which was sort of trying to have a basically soy-based vegan diet, but they recognized that they couldn't just eat soybeans even though they were so protein rich, so they started investigating different traditional ways of preparing soybeans. They learned about tempeh from food scientists at Cornell, as I understand it. And they obtained a sample of a starter for tempeh that was a pure culture starter of a mold called Rhizopus oligosporus that actually... the USDA maintains a culture collection, and they basically obtained a sample of the strain of Rhizopus oligosporus that's in the USDA's culture collection, and it's called Var Saito, and Saito is a Japanese microbiologist who, I guess, is the first microbiologist who really investigated tempeh, and, out of the tempeh sort of picked that particular strain out as the sort of active principle of the tempeh. And in microbiology, this has really been, the approach to fermentation is sort of, look at these, undefined, groups of organisms that are found on different traditional foods and really pick out the essential organisms, out of that to get rid of everything that's extraneous. Because the bias in microbiology is that, in general, microorganisms are, dangerous. And, we should just figure out what the specifically functional ones are and get rid of all the other ones. So, in a laboratory under sterile conditions, it's pretty easy to propagate a pure strain fungus. But in a home kitchen, it's extremely challenging, and I would say it's the most challenging thing that I've ever done in the realm of fermentation is trying to propagate pure culture Rhizopus oligosporus. And I've done it a few times, but with limited success. But I was amazed when I went to Indonesia and visited a village where they produce tempeh, to see what the source of the culture was. And it basically, this guy pulled down a shoebox filled with these moldy leaves of a particular tree. They call it the waru tree. It's a hibiscus family tree. And basically each time they make tempeh, they take a few of the beans out and, place maybe a half dozen beans between two leaves of this tree that's right outside their compound, and then overripen it. So when they peel the leaves, apart, it's a whole mycelial mat, but it's also, it's also sort of turned a dark color, the color of sporulation of that particular mold. Or though it's actually a couple of colors. There's like tan ones that are indicative of Aspergillus molds, along with black ones that are indicative of Rhizopus molds. So they're working with a mixed community that evidently has the ability to perpetuate itself pretty easily. So basically, the way that they made tempeh is, you know, they had dehulled the beans and split them and cooked them, and then laid them out on this big table to dry. And their batch was basically a 50 kilo bag of soybeans. So it's like 100 pounds of dry soybeans that they had dehulled and split and cooked, and they were drying it and cooling it. And once you get rid of most of the surface moisture and you get it down to body temperature, then it's time to introduce the culture. And the way they did that is, this guy took one leaf in each of his hands and then just sort of, dug into the soybeans, lifted up a handful, and moved his hands against each other, basically to rub these leaves against the surfaces of lots of beans. And then he'd just like pick up another handful and rub them and just try to get different portions of this big pile of soybeans. And then at the end, once he felt they were adequately cultured, before putting it all in, the bags that serve as the forms for the blocks of tempeh, he perpetuated it by taking a few of the beans and putting it between some leaves and doing maybe a half a dozen set of leaves like that to perpetuate it. But I just loved the simplicity of how, in their little, sort of low-tech village operation, they were able to perpetuate it, in contrast to, the extraordinary sterilization methods that are required for perpetuating sort of the single strain that we're mostly working with in the U.S. And to me, it was just, a story of how, sort of the science of microbiology, with its biases against these broad, undefined communities of organisms, which are really what all traditional fermentations are based on, in an effort to improve on the cultures, they've actually, disempowered people and made it something that it's impossible for, the casual generalist to propagate. And, there's a similar story in relation to yogurt, where, if you go to the store and buy a container of plain yogurt, it's easy to make yogurt from it. but the second generation will never be quite as nice as the first one. And by the time you do three or four generations, you really have to go back to the store and buy another container of yogurt. And the story is exactly analogous, where, traditional yogurt is always based on these elaborate communities that have evolved together and evolved structures that include defense, protectiveness for their own perpetuation as a community. And when microbiology sought to improve upon that sort of inherited undefined community and selected a couple of elements of it as the defining organisms for yogurt, I mean, all the commercial yogurt now is made from isolated, laboratory propagated bacterial lines that are mixed together. So, you get your Lactobacillus bulgaricus, your Streptococcus thermophilus, maybe a third or a fourth line is added into that. But, it's a little bit like an arranged marriage. And it's just, it could make great yogurt for a batch or two, but it just does not have this sort of evolved structure to it. And it doesn't really have strategies to protect itself. And that's why when you use the store yogurt, it peters out after a few generations, just because, other bacteria enter the mix and the original ones, kind of end up being marginalized and disappearing after a few generations. I'm really interested in all of these sort of, traditional inherited cultures, and, a little bit like, heirloom seeds, there are these things that, really have been very, very localized, and I think particularly with the milk cultures, I mean, a lot of them have been lost already, you know, just sort of with globalized yogurt. You know, I think that a lot of the sort of, you know, quirky, you know, traditional, you know, cultures that people were using for their lineages of sour milk, you know, have largely been displaced by yogurt. And I mean, I love yogurt, but I mean, I just think it's so, you know, cool that people in every part of the world that domesticated animals for their milk have really distinctive styles of fermented milk. And, you know, I think that they are, you know, worth preserving.
So what was your first memory of eating a fermented food?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly in my first memory, I didn't know the word fermentation and I wasn't thinking about it as a fermented food. But I mean, you know, one of the, you know, important foods that was, you know, like a backdrop to my whole childhood was sour pickles, you know, fermented pickles, sometimes known as kosher dill pickles, that are produced by fermentation rather than by pouring hot vinegar over them. And I mean, I just always was crazy about pickles. And, you know, when I started exploring, you know, I grew up in New York City. When I started exploring the city myself, you know, that was always like a cheap snack I could get with a little bit of pocket change. And I don't know, I just always loved pickles.
There's that flavor, the like sweet and salty flavor that it has that's like addictive. It got you early.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
How did you decide, or I don't know if it was in your decision, but to kind of lead the charge as a fermentation revivalist?
I mean, well, really what I mean, how I got interested in practicing fermentation was that, you know, 20 years ago in 1993, I moved from New York City to a community in rural Tennessee and got involved in keeping a garden. And, you know, the first season that I was gardening, you know, lo and behold, turns out all of the cabbages are ready at the same time in a garden, which hadn't really ever occurred to me. I hadn't thought about it. And so, you know, when suddenly there was this row of cabbages and what am I going to do with them all? You know, I've always, in addition to sour pickles, I've always loved sauerkraut. And I just was like, I'm going to learn how to make sauerkraut. And I like literally, you know, looked in the Joy of Cooking and found out how to make sauerkraut, and I made some sauerkraut, and you know, I loved it, and I just started to get a little bit obsessed with you know, sauerkraut and experimenting with different kinds of fermented vegetables. And then I started playing around with yogurt making and a little bit of cheese making and country wines, and you know, I just kind of developed an obsession with all things fermented and spent you know, like the rest of the 90s, you know, experimenting with all kinds of ferments. And then I got invited to teach a sauerkraut making workshop. These people at this other community in Tennessee that I was friendly with were hosting a food Skillshare gathering, and they invited me to teach a sauerkraut making workshop because I already had gotten a little reputation among people I knew for you know, being the kraut guy. So I did that, and I mean, that was a really memorable experience for me because, you know, I had no fear learning about sauerkraut, but I learned that like a lot of people project their fear of bacteria and food poisoning, you know, onto a process as simple as sauerkraut. So, you know, I had a really fun time kind of, you know, dispelling that, you know, that idea and demystifying sauerkraut for people. And then I started getting invited every year to do that. And then in 2001, I spent the summer at my friend's place in Maine, and so I was missing this annual event, and, you know, I wasn't quite as jet-set then as I have become, so it didn't occur to me that I should just, like, you know, go for a long weekend to this event that I was feeling sad about missing, and instead I spent, like, most of a month, you know, writing down my you know, fermentation recipes into a little booklet that I self-published. I made 100 copies of it, and that was also called Wild Fermentation. That was Wild Fermentation, a do-it-yourself guide to cultural manipulation. And, you know, as soon as I wrote that, I realized that this would be a great thing to write a book about. And, you know, I started thinking about how I would expand it into a book. I started doing some research because I wanted to kind of, you know, contextualize the process more broadly. And I was able to find a publisher. And so, you know, then I wrote Wild Fermentation. And then, you know, then I started getting invited to teach in lots of different kinds of places. So, I mean, that's the story of how I, you know, found my calling.
Sure. Yeah. The charge was given to you. Or did you see it? Was there like this vacuum you saw that you were like, you know what, that needs to get filled?
Well, I mean, I mean, to a certain degree, when I realized this would be a great thing to write a book about, it was, you know, because there was, I mean, you know, there is a lot of information out there in the world about fermentation. It's just there aren't that many, you know, books that have, you know, brought them together in one place. So, you know, as I was researching, I mean, there was really no shortage of information at all. It's just, it's all in more specialized sources. So, you know, great. There's all these books about beer and wine making. There's all these books about baking with sourdough. There's books about cheese making. You know, there's, you know, there were a few other books that I was aware of that were about fermentation more broadly. Bill Mollison's book, which was published, you know, I think in the early 90s, I had a copy of, and that was very helpful to me. I kept seeing reference to, and eventually I found a university library with a copy of Keith Steinkraus's book, which is, you know, really, I'd say the most comprehensive book in the English language about fermentation. It's called the Handbook of Indigenous Fermented Foods. But, you know, that's like a scientific academic tome that, you know, costs, you know, $250 or something. But no, I mean, I really just, I mean, I just fell into it, you know, one step at a time. You know, at first it was just like a practical response to what was coming out of the garden. You know, then it was like sharing my enthusiasm with people, you know, right around me. Then, you know, because I was missing that one year, I was like, well, I better put this down on paper and send it down there. And then, you know, it was only when I began writing about it. You know, I think as a young person, I had always, you know, had the idea that it would be great to be a writer. But like most, you know, young people who want to be writers, I had no idea what to write about. So, you know, suddenly here was something compelling to write about.
I'm curious a little bit more about your obsession with fermented foods. Like, why, what is it that unites, you know, you're talking about some people have obsessions with sourdough, or not obsessions, but they write about that or they talk about one thing. But you have managed to kind of look at it in this broad swath of kind of living bacteria that are, and you know, fungi that are bringing flavor out?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's the strong flavors that really unite, you know, all the different products of fermentation. And, you know, if you walk into a gourmet food store anywhere and like look around and think about the nature of the foods that were, you know, calling gourmet foods, they're almost all products of fermentation. You know, fermentation creates these strong flavors, and, you know, foods that are, you know, widely disparate are products of microbial processes. I mean, you know, think, you know, salami, coffee, chocolate, vanilla, cured meats, you know, really condiments are something I love to talk to people about, because, you know, condiments either are directly fermented, as in, you know, fish sauce, the mother of all condiments, or soy sauce, you know, or like in our, you know, contemporary American condiments, they use vinegar, a product of fermentation, as their stabilizer. So, and really like almost all condiments, you know, all around the world, you know, at least use vinegar as a stabilizer. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's really like the strong flavors, you know, and the fact that they are, you know, microbially produced. And I mean, I find the, you know, the idea of like relating to these invisible life forces and seeing how dramatically they can change things, you know, really exciting and compelling. And, you know, for me, that's really what unites, you know, all the different realms of fermentation is, you know, I mean, there's some overlap in terms of the type of organisms, but really it's the sort of like, you know, magic or alchemy of, you know, engaging with these invisible life forces. And I think that was sort of like an aspect of it that really drew me in.
It almost sounds like fermentation is a spiritual practice.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's that's you know, a part of it. And you know, I think if you look around the world at you know, surviving practices of indigenous people, you actually see a huge amount of, you know, ritual and ceremony organized around fermentation. I mean, it's been recognized as a mystical process by, you know, sort of disparate traditions around the world. And you know, even in you know, some of the what we call the major world religions, you know, basically the ones that don't condemn, you know, alcohol, you know, consider it a sacrament. And, you know, it's very, very, very powerful stuff. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that for, you know, people, you know, before there was like a scientific explanation to it and we had microscopes and could actually sort of see these organisms and understand that they're, you know, sort of reproducing and metabolizing nutrients, you know, it's a very sort of, you know, mystical transformation. You know, what's going on in there? You know, we don't really know. It's some kind of a magic. So yeah, I do think it's spiritual. And I also think in terms of, you know, people's, you know, interest in it. I mean, I would say that, you know, with food in general and the sort of, you know, craving for more connection to our food, I mean, there's definitely practical aspects to it. There are, you know, nutritional aspects to it. There are economic aspects to it. But I also, you know, believe and observe that at some level, it's a real sort of, you know, spiritual longing, you know, that sort of not having that connection to the earth has left people feeling, you know, severed. And, you know, the fact that, you know, so many people, you know, are sort of feeling this, you know, pull to become more connected to their food and the sources of their food, you know, at one level, it really is a spiritual searching, or it's, you know, filling a, you know, a spiritual void.
Do you have any cultures that you have maintained from the beginning that have been with you all along, or others that have been with you quite a long time?
Not really. I mean, I would say that, you know, I have been best at wild fermentation, at, you know, ferments which are based on the organisms that are spontaneously found on the food, which, you know, you just start it with the food. And, you know, now I have a yogurt culture that I've kept going, you know, just for like probably 4 years. I have a sourdough that I've kept going for probably 10 years, but definitely not from the beginning. I mean, I've lived in communal living environments with chaotic kitchens. I do a lot of traveling, like all the, you know, all the SCOBYs, the, you know, kombucha and kefir and all the, you know, sort of cultures that generate these sort of macro physical forms require, you know, regular feeding. And, you know, when you travel as much as I do, it's really hard to keep them going. It's like keeping a dog when you travel all the time. You know, they just need a certain amount of attention. So, no, at this point, I mean, I'm not even really trying to keep SCOBYs going. I don't have like kefir or kombucha regularly going. I use them in teaching. So I have, you know, I have friends who maintain these things. So, you know, I always have, you know, access to, you know, using them for demonstration purposes, but I'm not even trying. I mean, for a couple of years, I was actually like paying a friend of mine to like take care of kefir, and you know, it was really just became very costly. You know, I was paying for milk and paying for his time, and I don't know. I just realized I didn't need to really keep him going all the time.
Sure. So you published Wild Fermentations. That was 10 years ago now. I'm curious, in that time, I don't know if you've discovered new processes, new foods. What has anything happened recently that's kept you kind of excited about fermented foods?
Well, I mean, first let me just say, I mean, I always feel excited about fermented sure. foods, and you know, they don't have to be you know, novel for me to you know, be excited about them. But I would say, you know, two things. I mean, one is that you know, I have been very, you know, lucky in that I've been, you know, getting invited to different parts of the world to talk about fermentation. And, you know, whenever I travel, you know, internationally, I end up encountering, you know, new kinds of fermented foods that I haven't tried before. A year and a half ago, I got invited to Indonesia, and, you know, I learned about lots of different foods that I didn't know about, you know, how, you know, cultures being used in ways that I had never heard about. And so, you know, that's incredibly exciting. And, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, because people are always imagining that I have a comprehensive knowledge of fermentation, I mean, I feel really clear that it would just be impossible for any human being to sort of like, or any one human being to just like, you know, contain the, you know, infinite, you know, variation of fermentation practices that exist around the world. So I find that, you know, continually exciting. And then the other thing is, because I do all of this teaching, you know, a lot of times people will, show up at my workshops, wanting to share things that they've fermented. So I'm always getting to see these, like, you know, clever, flavor and seasoning variations, just that people who come to the workshops have thought of. So, you know, that's always a lot of fun. I love to cook. I'm pretty much like a creature of habit. When I find a way that I like to do things, I'll often just do it the same way. And I haven't really been wildly experimental in my flavoring of sauerkrauts. But, like, you know, I'm thinking of this woman, Sasha, who showed up at a workshop maybe a year ago, and it had vanilla beans in the sauerkraut. And I never would have thought of that. It seemed so weird, but it was so delicious. So I feel like, you know, I'm continually being stimulated by new ideas, whether it's like traditions I've never heard about or just, you know, people's creative applications of, old traditions to new kinds of ingredients.
That was Sander Katz, author of Wild Fermentations. In a minute, we'll have our monthly garden check-in with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. As the days get longer, the garden to-do list is rapidly expanding. As my first planting of radishes are nearing ready to harvest, I find I'm becoming more and more frantic to get more plants into the ground. To help us sort through all that garden work, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So before we jump into our gardening segment, I want to talk about some of your other projects here in Portland. How long have you been teaching permaculture design?
I've been teaching permaculture design since around 2004. For those who aren't familiar with permaculture, it's a design system for developing sustainable and regenerative lifestyles that are based in the unique climate and resources of the place that we live. So each morning we all get up and we design our lives, and we make choices throughout the day that we invest our energy in various endeavors or products or services. Sometimes these investments are good investments for the future, and sometimes they're not so good investments. So the permaculture framework has helped me understand how I can invest in positive futures and positive future outcomes while also enjoying my life. And so that's mostly the focus of the permaculture design curriculum.
And what specifically can people learn when they attend your permaculture design classes?
Well, permaculture is based in observing nature. So we tune in to just like looking at our natural surroundings and developing our observational skills so that we can learn how nature creates sustainable systems. In permaculture, we think that all designs can be based in what we see in nature. And so from there, then we'll look at patterns. We'll look at how to steward our soil, how to manage our water so it's clean, how to clean pollutants if we have those in our soil or our water, how to grow food locally and throughout the year. It also expands into talking about local economics and community building and what we build our homes out of, how we use energy systems in our homes, what energy systems are most appropriate for our climate. And we also talk about different climates, too. And so people can be aware while they're drinking their fabulous cup of coffee from Central America, you know, how that needs to be grown so they can support people in other parts of the world, too, to be stewarding this planet in a good way.
Great. I also want to talk about you run a neighborhood plant nursery. What are the benefits of buying and planting plants that are grown here in Portland?
Well, local plants are adapted to the local climate. And for your listeners who are just listening to Sander Katz, he mentioned that also about the local microbes when you're doing fermented foods. So when we grow local plants, we know that they've been adapted to the climate, that they've grown for years and years in our environment, and that they'll be resilient so that we'll need to do less work to be able to keep them going. When people buy plants from a local nursery that is has been growing those plants, that didn't buy the seed, buy the stock from somewhere else, then you're able to ask all the questions you want of how to grow the plant, what conditions might it become invasive, where might it struggle, when's it going to flower, what beneficial insects is it going to attract, or, you know, how do I pick the tomato that's just going to be bomb-proof no matter what our summer is?
What kind of plants are you growing right now?
Well, I grow lots of different vegetables. Many of them are seeds that I've saved myself and some of the varieties that I've grown out over the years that I purchased the seeds. And that's just based on pollination requirements in the city. I select varieties that are beautiful, that are extremely reliable, that are easy to grow, tasty, of course. So I have lots of different vegetables. I also have medicinal herbs, culinary herbs, plants that provide ecological functions so that we can be attracting pollinators and building soil with our plant choices. I have some berry bushes as well. So it's a pretty big diversity of plants. And I've been growing my own food for over the past 10 years now, year round, my own produce. And so, and as well as my own medicine. And so what I have is what is in my apothecary or what I find in my cupboards and in my meals throughout the year.
And it sounds like it's going well. Are most of the people who are buying the plants, are they coming from your neighborhood?
There's a lot that are coming from my neighborhood, but I have people that come from further out as well. Sometimes some of the things that I have are rare. My dream is that I can collect plants that remind people of their grandmother, like those old varieties that are being lost. And so whether someone is from this country or from another country, if I can have unique edibles that bring them back to, you know, grandma's garden, that would be really dreamy. One that I'm excited about this year is Gai Lan, which is a Chinese broccoli that I think produces better than most of our sprouting broccolis. So whether people are in my neighborhood or in the greater Portland region, or even, you know, I've had people come down from Washington looking for stuff. And I have my my plant list is updated and it's posted on my website.
Great. So I want to now transition because we've got a lot to talk about with the garden. What kind of plants should we be getting in the ground right now?
Well, you already got your radishes going, so you can plant radishes in succession right now. I've been planting my Brassicaceae starts, so that's broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage. All of those plants, I find that they get really eaten by slugs, so I prefer to plant starts rather than direct sow because the direct sown plants tend to be more susceptible because they're young and vulnerable. I'm planting lettuces right now. Those can be planted both by seed or by starts. Parsnips are best planted by seed, as well as those radishes. They're best planted by seed. Most root crops are best planted by seeds because you want to encourage that root growth. So that's a general rule of thumb. And a lot of these root crops can be planted now, including beets and carrots and turnips. So all of those can go in.
So you talked about some that we should get in the ground now. What should we wait to plant?
Definitely wait on planting all the warm weather crops. You know, I was somewhere yesterday and I saw tomatoes for sale. So tomatoes shouldn't be planted until the outdoor air temperatures are at least 50 degrees. And I meant to check my greenhouse thermometer before I left, but I know that yesterday my greenhouse was still around 40 degrees at night. So really wait until it's 50 degrees outside in the evening for your tomatoes. As well as your peppers, they need it even warmer than tomatoes. Eggplants want it about as warm as the peppers. I'm waiting on my squashes and my pumpkins. I think sunflowers might be okay right now, but you might want to not plant the whole seed packet. I saw some sunflowers that germinated in the neighborhood. So I usually look around and see what's coming up naturally without being planted to get a guideline of what can be growing now.
So when you're getting ready to put seeds or plants in your garden bed, what are the steps you take to get the bed ready?
Well, I'll rake back the mulch so that I can warm up the soil. I like to do a soil test. A&L Labs in Tigard is really great for soil tests. It's always good to know what you need. Then you can add compost. I certainly want to weed before the weeds flower. And I like to wet the bed down before I plant in it so that it's receptive for those plants' roots.
And as the season goes along, you mentioned wanting to know what the soil needs. But as the season goes along, the plants will gradually draw nutrients from the soil. So what can we do now to build up that soil health?
Well, first doing a soil test to know what you're going to need. And then adding compost, managing your compost pile. It's good to add lime every spring. Of course, it's good to know what your pH is. Certainly blueberries often don't need that. They want a pH of around 4.5 to 5.5. But garden soil want a pH of pretty much slightly acidic to neutral for growing most of the things that we want.
So you mentioned compost. What can we be doing now to get a healthy compost pile going?
Well, the first thing is to gather materials, to get a good list of what compost materials you have available to you and whether you have enough in your home for how much compost you want to generate or if you can reach out in your greater neighborhood. Find a good spot to get your compost pile going. And usually that's someplace that connects with the soil, because when you have a compost pile on bare soil, then the soil microbes can come up into your compost pile. If you have a compost pile on concrete or you do one of those rotating compost bins, it's important to add microbes so you've got them being able to break it down for you. And then you want to balance your greens and browns, your nitrogen-rich materials and your carbon-rich materials, or your juicies and your crunchies, as I like to call it. Cover your compost pile during the rain, since we've been still getting a lot of it, and then take the temperature as it composts. And as the temperature subsides, it's a good time to turn it.
So something I'm running into, I've got peas that are coming up, and they are getting munched. And you mentioned slugs, you mentioned pests. What can we do now to fend off pests?
Oh, it's your peas. Yeah, so peas were tough in the beginning of the year to get started because it was so wet and many people's peas rotted. And now you got squirrels eating them, and I do too. And what I do is I get those shiny little pinwheels at the dollar store, and I put those in my garden in the places where I want to deter the squirrels. You could also use some bird scare tape or flashy CDs. Anything that makes it look like there's fire there helps keep them away.
What else can we be doing right now to help those plants along besides helping to fend off the pests?
Top dressing with compost. It's real good. Mm-hmm.
And so it is still raining, and it will be for a little while, but gradually we're going to have less and less rain. When should we start thinking about water and irrigation?
Well, the best time to think about it is right now, because right now all the plants are low and you're planning out where you're going to plant things. So you also want to plan out how you're going to move the hose through the garden if you water by hand like I do, or how you're going to lay out your irrigation system. And you want to be able to troubleshoot it and make sure it's working before you really need it going, and that it's going to be pretty foolproof and reliable for the whole season. So folks shouldn't forget about those 100-degree days that we had in May. They came on quick, and that could happen again. So it's a good time to just get your irrigation and water system in place now, as well as, you know, just to stress again how important compost is in the garden. When you have 2% compost in your garden, it can reduce your need for irrigation by 75%. So if you've got a lot of compost, that can be the difference between watering every day and watering every four.
Great. So people have a lot to digest now, things they can do in their garden. Before you go, do you have any workshops or things coming up?
Yeah, I have my next permaculture design course, which offers the full 2-week permaculture design curriculum, is at Aprovecho Learning Center in Cottage Grove in May, and that's 2 weeks. It's going to be with Jude Hobbs and Abel Kloster, which are both very great teachers. And Aprovecho is a wonderful place for learning about lots of the different permaculture examples as well as appropriate technology. The next class in my Grow Your Own Produce workshop series is on Tuesday, May 2nd at People's Food Co-op from 7 to 9 p.m. And then I'm having plant sales now, generally every 2 weeks. I think the next one is going to be on Sunday, April 30th. Although the nursery is also open by appointment. And I have plant packages that people can order if they know they want to attract more pollinators in their garden or have a rock and salsa garden, but you're not sure exactly what plants you need. I'm offering a edible flower package, a pollinator plant package, and various things. So all of that can be found on permaculturerising.com.
Marisha, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your garden knowledge.
Thanks, Chris.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. For more information about the classes Marisha offers, you can visit her website, permaculturerising.com, or head on over to the KBOO Food Show page. In a moment, we'll hear from Joan Nathan, author of several Jewish cookbooks, including her most recent book, King Solomon's Table. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. I recently came across a cookbook that has made my kitchen explode with new flavors. In her new book, King Solomon's Table, A Culinary Exploration of Jewish Cooking from Around the World, Joan Nathan has collected a wide variety of traditional Jewish recipes that each have a regional flair. Joan was in Portland giving a talk about the book, and I was fortunate enough to get a chance to talk with her. Here's my interview with Joan Nathan. What's your background in food? What brought you to making this cookbook?
Well, I've written 11 Jewish cookbooks before, and I'd written one on Jewish cooking in America, which has just become an American classic for the International Association of Culinary Professionals. It was just announced last week. And I wrote one on the Jewish holidays. I wrote one on the Jews of France. I wrote one on two on Israeli food. And then I thought, you know, I'd like to sort of bring everything around and show the world. And that's what I did in this book. So I went traveling to about 30 different places. And, you know, of course, some of it was done a long time ago. But certain places, like in Italy, I spent a lot of time. And I spent a lot of time with the Libyans in Israel because the Libyan community has really wonderful food, and it's just going to be dead in the next few years because there are no more Jews in Libya. And there are a lot of countries, there are no more Jews. Like, I really wanted to write about the Iraqi Jews. So I went to London and I learned about them there. And I spent days with all these wonderful cooks in London, in Rome, in Florence. And they showed me how they cooked. And they also told me their stories that you just don't get them just by talking to somebody. You've got to spend days with them, and then they open up. And it was really such an honor for me to be able to do this and to be able to share with my readers. And, you know, from the reaction to the book so far, everyone's really happy. It was number two on Amazon last week, of all books.
Not just cookbooks. What is one of the recipes in the book that really gets you excited?
Oh, there's so many of them. Well, I'll tell you one recipe. It's called Schritzlach, and it's a blueberry bun. And it's the iconic Jewish food in Toronto, Canada. And I heard about this recipe from looking at Mimi Sheraton's book on 1,000 things you're supposed to want to eat before you die. And one of them was this Schritzlach. So I looked it up and I started testing recipes for it. And what it was like an oblong pastry filled with blueberries. Cloves, put the sugar on top, like a sugar icing, and baked. And I thought, well, buns, because Toronto's an English town, right? But I'd never heard of this pastry. And I went to, I was making the pastry at my house. I looked at recipes and I played around with the recipes. And then I called somebody named Mitchell Davis, who's the vice president of the James Beard Foundation in New York, and I said, and I knew he was from Toronto, and I said, did you ever have something called Schritzlach? And he said, yes, and it was filled with blueberry pie filling. It was disgusting. So I realized, I looked up, when was blueberry pie filling invented? And it was in the 50s. And sure, that was a cheap thing. It was new. They put that instead of the blueberries, and he just didn't like it. So I started playing around with the recipe, and I was testing it. And a girl who always stays at my house from California was staying there, and I told her what I was making, and she looked at me. She came in the house, looked at what I was doing, looked at this oblong pastry, and she said, that's just what my grandma made, but hers was better. So she came in the kitchen with me. We remade the recipe, and then I thought a little bit of candied ginger would give it a zing. So I remade it, and it's really a delicious recipe. But then I discovered that her mother, her grandmother, came from 30 miles away from the woman who was baking them in Toronto. And they were both from Southwest Poland. And I realized they were all both religious Jews. And that at the time of the Nazis, that they came right through towns that were religious because you could tell by the clothes they wore and just took the Jews away. And that a recipe like this, or culture, or whatever, music from these towns was gone. And then it hadn't been for these two women who came to the new world, you know, in the 20s, we wouldn't have had this recipe. You know, I mean, of course, we wouldn't have had life either. But the point is that there are recipes, and recipes are part of our culture, along with the people. And they're dying all the time, and we've got to resuscitate them.
Absolutely. It makes me think of the, you know, I hate to bring the current political landscape into this conversation, but you can't escape it. It makes me think of the thing that Sean Spicer recently said, bringing Hitler mistakenly into a press briefing. Just that right now there's a lot of anti-Semitism, hate rhetoric, and there really is the need for people to connect. And food really is that sort of universal connector. What do you want to accomplish with this cookbook?
Well, I think that what I want to accomplish is, first of all, something that I wanted to do. And that's connecting everything together and showing that all of us are immigrants. I don't care who we are in the United States. We're all immigrants, every one of us. And I wanted to just have the circles connect. Like, I think of Jewish food as like a bagel. It goes around and around. And that Jewish immigrants or emigrants would go around and around looking for foods, looking for a safe haven, and bringing whatever recipes they came from, had from the time before. And, you know, and they were able to keep them. And it's just like what's going on today. So I didn't realize how prescient this book was, but it certainly was. And I think that's part of the reason that it's gotten amazing reviews, and it's also so popular because of the immigrant nature of the book.
Could you tell us a little bit about the name of the cookbook, King Solomon's Table?
Well, King Solomon's Table was the name my editor thought about after I told her I was in India and I saw a sign that said that Jews had been there since the time of King Solomon, looking for spices and jewels and stones and even peacocks. So I realized that Jews were looking in the then-known world, in the Arabian Sea, in the Indian Ocean, for new foods to bring back to the temple. And I thought that King Solomon was a metaphor, not only for wisdom, but he was a metaphor for somebody who really had large appetites. He had 700 wives, after all, and 300 concubines, but that was a sense of power as the head of a peoples, and that he was the first ruler to go out looking for the new and trying to incorporate them into where he lived. And since then, of course, Jews have always been merchants. They've always been looking for the new. And, you know, and they've had to been kicked out and they've had to adapt to the new. So it just seemed that he was the person to write about. And it's a good title.
So you collect a lot of recipes, and I remember reading in one of the recipes that you got it from someone, and they wanted you to put your own stamp on the recipe. So I'm curious, I feel like a lot of these are probably recipes that exist that you put your own stamp on. What is that?
Well, I think that putting my own stamp on it means just giving it a little bit more life. The person who gave me that recipe, I believe it was the leek patties with meat. And she said, you know, it's something that we always ate, and it really isn't very good. And I had thought about it because somebody else had given me that. There's a lot of recipes that people gave. you, and that they're not necessarily good. We have a lot more spices. We're better cooks. You know, we want more than just gray food for Jewish food. So I decided to roast my leeks rather than to fry them, and put a little bit of spice in it. And it's a really delicious recipe. I'm my mouth is watering just for tasting it. And the woman who gave it to me made it herself again, and she thanked me for it. So, you know, you want to have, I don't know what the word is, you want the real recipe, but you don't want it to be a bad recipe. So, and that's what the liberties that I've taken.
So you talk about the flavor. When I think of Jewish cooking, I think of Jewish deli, and this is not that. How is this cookbook different?
Well, I think this cookbook is Jewish food from the whole diaspora. There's some deli food. There's somebody who makes his own corned beef. You know, there are other things. There are potato latkes. There are kugels. But it's from all the diaspora. I have things from Georgia, Russia. I have things from Azerbaijan, a wonderful kukusa, an omelet dish. I have things from Poland that are different, from El Salvador, a chocolate salami from Germany that ended up with the 100 Jews of El Salvador. I have a delicious sweet and sour cabbage that came from a Turkish Jew in Cuba. So I, you know, in my book, I tried to show the wandering nature of the Jews, that it's not just one country they've been to, but most have been to at least 2, 3, 4 countries before they came to the United States or wherever they came.
So it sounds like you did a fair amount of traveling, and that has led to this cookbook. Is there any like story of a place that you were in and an experience that you had that kind of fed into this cookbook?
Oh, big time, lots of them. I think the El Salvadorian one was pretty extraordinary. You know, here I was in I heard about this dish, this chocolate salami, and I decided to go all the way to El Salvador, which I did. Luckily, I knew the ambassador, and she let me stay at her house. And it never occurred to me that there were only 100 Jews in El Salvador. And these were people who had lived there since about the middle of the 19th century. They came because one person opened a German-Jewish department store. The others took their places in the department store. And then this elderly woman, she's in her 90s now, came from Berlin to Brazil, and then to El Salvador. So she married another German, and because this was my guess is this was a dish that was used for the Shabbat dinner. It's parve, which means there's no butter or no milk, so that you could eat it with a meat meal, and people would freeze this salami of chocolate with a filling of almond paste. You'd cut it, and then everybody ate it, so that it became a symbol for this dish in this home. And now, of course, El Salvadorian cooks make it, and it's just this one family uses, but their children are all over the world, and they're wherever they are, they make that for Friday night. And it just seemed to me pretty interesting that that's what happened.
Well, Joan, I really appreciate you compiling these recipes and bringing this sort of cultural and culinary exploration into my kitchen. Thank you very much for talking with me on the food show.
And thank you for having me.
That was Joan Nathan, author of the cookbook King Solomon's Table. And that's it for this episode of the food show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kbu.fm. I want to thank our guests, Sander Katz, Joan Nathan, and Marisha Auerbach for being on today's show. I also want to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives, and don't forget to tune in again next month, on the third Wednesday of May for another episode of The Food Show. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.